Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us again for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we talk with a leader and they share lessons learned from their career. And this week, we're going to be taking a look at our first podcast, Episode 1, an interview that we conducted with Greg Lehman. Greg is a CEO, board member. Early in his career, he was a college president at Taylor University. He's currently the CEO at The Difference Card. And he is a thought leader in the area of healthcare, but has some just great insights he's going to share with us. And looking forward to revisiting this conversation with Greg. I'm joining us from Nashville. It's a little warmer there than it is here in Minneapolis, but looking forward to the conversation. I was looking back at my notes, Greg, and we met back in 2011. It's hard to believe it's been that long, and I didn't remember exactly when that was, but have enjoyed our conversations over the years. I guess one of the first things that we want to do as a part of this is to kind of help young leaders as they're coming into the marketplace, and to help them have a more successful career. And you've got a wealth of background and experience. Maybe give just a quick high-level view of your background and kind of as you came out of school at Purdue, you graduated, just kind of what you were thinking about at that time, and just a quick high level of what you've done.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity. And I agree, time flies. I couldn't remember what the year was when we became friends, but that sounds about right. So thanks for allowing me to share some thoughts. So yeah, I was at Purdue, got my master's and PhD on a fast track back in, I don't know if I should say when, but it's 1973. So sure. As a 71-year-old, I'm still a CEO, still active in board work. And when I graduated, though, in 1973, I really thought I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, I used that opportunity to do what I call stepping stone jobs. So I have a PhD in higher education administration, a minor in finance and economics, and also computer science. So kind of an eclectic mix. I first went into higher education working at a Christian college in Indiana called Taylor University, and was there for about 10 years and advanced from VP level to executive VP to president. And at that time had two little sons and decided that it was time to hand over the baton to somebody else. So my executive VP took over for me, and I did an executive in residence at Cornell, or at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and that's what got me to Nashville. So the reason I say I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, I really thought I wanted to teach in higher education. Then I thought, you know, my skill set's really more of a leader, and started working in administrative posts and finance and fundraising, which is development, and right. And then in executive leadership. And that was fun. It was a 17-year career for me. And then I decided what my real passion was, and that's fixing underperforming institutions, whether they're not-for-profits, mm-hmm. whether they're for-profits. It really didn't matter. So I really started out even working with trade associations. So one of my CEO stopping points was at the National Federation of Independent Business, as well as the National Business Coalition on Health, both of them in Washington, D.C. Okay. So I got a little taste of life inside the Beltway, or they call it Potomac fever. and I just had a restlessness in my spirit about what my niche was. And interestingly enough, I decided that my niche wasn't a specific company or a specific job title. what I found out with all these jobs is that it was more of a mosaic. So you see one piece and you look at that piece of the mosaic and you say, how does this have anything to do with my training? How does this have anything to do with what I thought I wanted to do? And at the end of the day, I said, the job was just a piece of that mosaic. Some I really liked, some I disliked a lot, but they all were stepping stones and building blocks to what now is a beautiful picture. Each piece of the mosaic fits together. And I tell a lot of younger executives, don't shy away from a job that you may not like or you don't feel qualified to do. I've done many of those, but they've all been great stepping stones and learning experiences for me.
Absolutely.
I said the college degree is basically a box you check to get into the job market. And the way I look at it is I'm a lifelong learner. And I am who I am today because of all my experiences that culminated into what made me good. So by the time I turned 50, to kind of summarize this, I realized that I'm really good at fixing underperforming companies, as I said before. So they have ranged from not-for-profits, private equity owned companies, a couple of public companies, actually two in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I'm also on the board of another company that's publicly traded. So I understand board governance. I learned from other mentors. And I think mentoring is really important. So I'm to the point in my career where I don't have mentors anymore, but I'm mentoring a number of young people, men and women, who do not have the experience I've had and can learn from my mistakes. Actually, I've learned more from my mistakes than my successes. And, you know, it's not about the end, it's about the journey. Yeah. So that's been the culmination of my life story right there.
Great. No, it's great to hear kind of your journey in that. As you know, most people that go to college, a lot of times don't end up in the career that they thought they were going to go into, and that it is a journey of figuring out what it is that, how you're motivated, how you're wired. And so that's great to hear kind of your personal story. If you were to go back in time, able to go back in time and talk to a 22-year-old Greg Lehman about his career, what advice would you give him?
I would say don't be so sure of yourself in terms of what you think you're on earth to do. Because I was arrogant enough to say that at 22, my goal is to be a college president at age 35, and I succeeded at 34. And as I look back on that, that was a stupid statement because I learned a lot from that experience, but I really wasn't emotionally prepared. I was mentally prepared, but not emotionally prepared for that amount of pressure. Just because I hadn't had the experience to justify that. So I was type A, gung-ho, go-getter, always had to prove myself. I had a friend who's a Christian psychologist, and he said, why do you feel you have to succeed? And I said, to prove all those naysayers wrong. And they said, so what happens if you do fail? And I said, well, I can't fail. And they said, you will fail at something. You failed at different things. You failed at different things in life. Did it kill you? And I said, no. Did it make you bitter? And I said, not really. I said, I was disappointed, but I learned from it. And he said, well, there you go. So it's not going to kill you. It's a learning experience. It may be God's way of telling you to slow down and reflect and learn and then go forward. So I would tell my 22-year-old self, take a deep breath, you know, learn to walk before you run and savor each experience. And don't be so crass to say, this is what I'm going to do and this is where I'm going to end up, because your life experience, like the mosaic, is one little piece at a time. And you have to put all those pieces on a canvas to make sure that they, and then take a step back 10 feet and say, wow, that's a beautiful mosaic.
Tell me what advice maybe that you received would you ignore you know, if you were, again, talking to your 22-year-old self?
Well, it's interesting. I got some advice from some of my supervisors that, you know, and I hung on every word, and some of those supervisors really didn't have my best interests at heart. And so it goes back to what an old college president told me when I became a college president. He said, when people give you advice or heap praise on you, it's kind of like liniment, you know, that you rub on sore muscles. He said, if you rub it on your muscles, it actually helps alleviate the pain, but if you ingest it, it'll kill you. So what I was doing is ingesting all the advice and making a lot of bad decisions because of that, as opposed to just, you know, listening to it and processing it. And I think my best advice is learn how to take a step back, process it. What I do now is I get the counsel of a lot of wise people before I make a big decision. And I think that's really critical at a younger age, as opposed to just listening to one voice in your head. And, you know, if you're spiritually inclined, to pray about it, I like to keep a ledger that has, what are the pluses of what I think I am hearing? What are the minuses? And sometimes I've had two or three different opportunities in front of me. And once I take a step back, I usually do a personal retreat. I think it through. I talk to my peers, people that I respect, and put that ledger out in front of me, talk to my wife, and then I'm ready to make a decision. And usually it's a better decision than knee jerking. So in my younger years, I knee jerked a lot. I attributed that to being a free spirit and hungry, but it was just immaturity. Mm.
So how important is it? I know you mentioned that you're a mentor to many young leaders today, and have done that over the years, but how important was it to have a mentor? And are there specific people that you can look back on and say they were critical to your now success as far as an executive?
Yes, I've had three that come to mind that influenced who I am today. The first one was a retired board chairman of Pillsbury. He mentored me in graduate school and was like a father figure to me. And he was a tough critic, but also had very wise, sage advice that I listened to and learned from, and attribute a lot of to my leadership skills to his leadership and allowing me to pick his brain. And that was very important. The second one was a pastor who was a college president who mentored me when I was a very young college president who thought I knew more than I actually did. And he took me under his wing. He helped me with public speaking. He helped me organize my thoughts for public speaking. He taught me some great leadership skills, mostly by watching him. But he continually surrounded me with his love and his critique. And that was a big influence on my life. And the third person is actually a guy in the Twin Cities who was my board chairman for the two companies there. And he taught me more about board governance than anything I've ever read or even observing other boards. And when I look at stewardship, financial responsibility, financial accountability, ethical standards, this is my go-to guy. And I've thanked him many times, as I've thanked all of them, saying, I wouldn't be who I am today without your guidance and your leadership. And for most importantly, taking the time to spend with me let me use you as a sounding board, but also tell me when I was doing the wrong thing. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that.
That's great. You mentioned as far as that you've learned some through life experience and through your mentors. Are there any books that are at the top of your list that you believe that are must reads for a young executive, or even those that are in the career that are looking to grow and develop?
Well, there are many, but I have two or three that come to mind that I really, our go-to books, and they've been around for some for over a decade and others for longer than that. One of them was a funny title, but it's got a really strong content, is Who Moved My Cheese? That was Dr. Spencer Johnson. That's a book that he wrote. I keep it on my bookshelf. I refer to it a lot, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate the insights in that. The other one is a book that came out a long time ago by Robert Greenleaf called Servant Leadership. And I would say my style today is pretty much a mirror image of what is in that book. I really believe in servant leadership, and I know that I try to lead by example. I don't feel that I'm better than anybody on my executive team. Most of my jobs are the C-suite, the CEO level for the last several decades. And I always say I'm the first among equals. The buck stops with me, but I need all of you to pull in the same direction. And then one that I read recently that's been around about a decade called The Go-Giver. You've heard about go-getters.
Right.
The Go-Giver is a book by Bob Berg and John David Mann. A powerful, powerful book about paying it forward and listening and encouraging people in your companies, as opposed to being arrogant and a browbeating, I'm the boss type mentality. And I've had employees from companies that I've worked at 20 years ago say, we've never had a CEO before or since you were there because you took the time to listen, to get to know us, to be an encourager. I had one guy that I had to terminate his employment, and he said, you did it with dignity. You didn't attack me. You just said you needed to make a change. You treated me fairly. And he said, I'll never forget that. So I would give that advice. And I think those three books that I mentioned are great illustrative examples of what I've just been talking about.
Right. Great. Yeah. No, I've read all three, and I would agree those are great books to have on your bookshelf. As you think about your career, and you stayed motivated, engaged throughout your career, what would you say is the main reason that you've kept your passion for what you're doing?
You know, that's a great question, and I think what has helped me keep my passion is each day is a new opportunity. I usually journal what I want to do that day, and then at the end of the day, what I learned that day. And I always see areas that I can improve. But I think the reason I stay passionate about what I do is I want to be an example to others to walk the talk. I know a lot of executives, unfortunately, that talk a lot, but they don't do what they say they expect others to do. So, I think, and then also creating shareholder value. I have a passion for taking underperforming companies and as I mentioned earlier, helping them perform on all cylinders. And sometimes that means in re-engaging and maybe changing the executive team. Sometimes that means that they're operating inefficiently. Sometimes it means they fall in love with ideas that are going to bankrupt the company, as opposed to as a lot of people have said, fail fast. If it's not going to work, and I've had those, cut your losses, dust yourself off, and try to provide shareholder value. And when I've been able to do that and sell companies and keep employees working and getting a regular paycheck, that's what drives me every day. I just love doing that and love fixing broken things. So, I'm not too good at fixing toasters, but I'm pretty good at fixing companies.
So as you're going through times where you're feeling maybe, I don't know if you ever feel overwhelmed, but I'm sure that there have been times that you have. How do you get back as far as focused on what you're doing? Are there some questions that you ask yourself if you're going through a time where it's challenging and you're facing some difficulties?
Yes. As a matter of fact, 2017 and 2018 were two of those years where I was chairman of the board of a publicly traded company that was in medical manufacturing. And it was had offices in Kansas City and a suburb of Detroit. We had the perfect storm hit, and I've never been so discouraged and stressed out in my entire career. But let me tell you what I did during that time. And so just to kind of paraphrase real shortly, what happened was I was brought on this board in 2014 to mentor a new CEO that had never been a CEO. The problem was he didn't want to be mentored. And so he basically said, I didn't know what I was talking about. He's no longer with the company. Sure. But that said, he overextended the company's credit and debt. And, you know, basically, there was a lot of Medicare payments to the company, and Medicare cut back what they were reimbursing, and the company took over a $5 million hit. Busted their bank covenants for their debt. We had an activist shareholder try to take over the company last year and oust me as chairman. We prevailed on all those things, and the company is back on track. And I'm now mentoring a guy that was head of sales, and he is now the CEO. But I had a lot of nights where I came home very discouraged. You know, I would just, my wife said, you're very quiet. What happened? And I said, I just don't want to rehash it, but just pray for me. And she got me to talk. And I also, you know, it's, as they say, it's very lonely at the top because you don't have anybody, you know, inside the company or other board members. But I did talk to one of my board members who was a friend of mine and on my board and in the Twin Cities. And, you know, I was very reflective, and I said, you know, to God, I know I have something here to learn. And what my takeaway was is that you still have to persevere. You still have to lead by example, and you can't let roadblocks or a brick wall stop your progress. Mm-hmm. And so I basically had that as my mantra, and it kind of goes back to a quote when I was in sales. It said, I never lose. Either I win or I learn. And I learned. I learned. And I didn't call those defeats. I just said, those are learning experiences. We're going to shore up the board. We're going to get a new CEO. I talked to a lot of shareholders. I traveled a lot, calming the markets, talked to banks. And I just said, you know what? Even if we fail, I have to lead by example. And so I sort of talked myself out of my doldrums, and with a lot of family and friends supporting me and loving me through it, and just said, you know, this too shall pass. And it did. So that's my advice. Just persevere, take a step back, be reflective, find friends you can talk to, you can counsel with, and recharge your battery. So I took a lot more time away, went to the beach with my wife, just to decompress. And that's the other advice that I have. I used to be such a type A that I would almost hit the wall and implode. And it's not worth it. Always take time off. Take the vacation allotted. You have to recharge, recreate in order to be effective, because hard times are going to come in every company.
It's great advice. I think as you're looking at kind of that passion and desire to, I think we've had this conversation that you're at a stage in your career that you mentioned some of your friends have already retired and are golfing and or sitting on the beach, and that you're still engaged with life and with what you're doing. And that's a great, I think, role model for somebody that's staying in the game and doing well. So I applaud you for that. As you're thinking about, and our business is about finding leaders for organizations, and what are some of the things as you're looking at building a team? What are some of the qualities that you look for in people that you bring on to your team? And give us a little bit of some of your thoughts around that.
That's a good question, Mark. I usually try to find people that are a lot smarter and subject matter experts in the areas that I'm not strong in, and that's the honest truth.
Sure.
But also, I want people that can help shape the culture of the company to a high-performing company. And in many cases, people look good on their resume, as you know, in your business, and they've got the credentials. but they're not the right fit for the cultural environment or the state of the business at a time when you need some help. So examples are oftentimes I would find subject matter experts in a manufacturing company as a case in point in Minneapolis that could help guide our R&D process because it was faltering and we had no new product releases in 10 years and we were losing money. I brought on a strong CFO who I had worked with before and I trusted. And so, you know, those are the attributes. Find people that are really good at what they do, people that you know you can trust, people that are ethical and smarter than I am. And so those combos are what I look for as opposed to, you know, being the right fit. Because sometimes you find somebody that's excellent on paper, but they're kind of a square peg in a round hole.
Right.
And, you know, even in your business, you're not perfect. You don't win every time. But, you know, baseball players aren't in the Hall of Fame hitting batting 1,000. They get in batting 350 or 450. And so that's the way I kind of look at it.
Do you have a favorite interview question that you like to ask candidates?
Yeah, I do. I have several, but a couple of one in particular that comes to mind. I like to throw them a curveball from time to time, as opposed to, you know, just saying, tell me about yourself, tell me about your career. Why are you interested in this company? But I really like to say, what's your passion in life? You know, what gets you to pound the table when you get up in the morning? What excites you? What hobbies do you have? How do you recharge your battery? How do you do? And, you know, I also like to talk about, I like to do kind of an interactive interview saying, okay, I'm the CEO. I'm going to disagree with you. And how are you going to handle that? And I usually give them an anecdote and say, this is what happened. How would you handle that if I approached you this way? And that tells me a lot about a person's character, how they do conflict resolution. And I also like to talk about their family. And you find out a lot about, you know, whether they're workaholics or whether they're family people. And then finally, I also ask about what are your top three priorities in life as a human being? Just tell me what makes you tick. And you usually find out a lot that way.
Are there any new habits or beliefs or behaviors that you've taken on as far as in the last 5 years that have improved your life?
Yes. I exercise more, and I've had some outpatient surgeries, and it slowed me down for a while. But I figure out that's the best way to clear my head. Is
right.
It doesn't have to be strenuous, but you know, I like to keep in shape, keep my mind sharp, and the best way to do that is force myself out of bed, have some quiet time, get out and walk, or run on the treadmill, or I have a rowing machine, so I like to exercise and clear the head out. The other thing that I found is very helpful is during stressful times or even in good times, journal. And journaling has been, you know, I've looked back when I was going through some of my toughest personal struggles back at some journals that I had 5, 6, 7 years ago. And how I approached those, I put the thing down on paper, and then what insights I had, and then what did I do about it? And those are some habits that I have adopted in the last 5 or 6 years that served me very well, even to this day. And then finally, the other habit is really listening and being there for my family and helping them out, whether it's personally or just little chores or doing something, being fully engaged when you're in business. And the new habit that I have is I take my phone out of my pocket, put it in the bathroom on the vanity, and I engage my wife. And if my kids are there or friends are there, I engage them, and I don't keep looking at my email messages till the next morning. And that has given me a new sense of purpose. It's calmed my spirit, allowed me to sleep better, and I'm just happier. I wish I'd done it 20 years ago.
Well, I'm not going to have my wife listen to this, but no, that's one of the things I need to do because I can't hard to unhook. I mean, we're,
yeah, it is. It is.
So it I think that's a great, I think people are always distracted and it's amazing. You sit in a restaurant and you look at, you can have four people around a table and they're all looking at their phones rather than looking at each other. And that's right. That's not a good way to live.
I've run board meetings where I've called out board members who are texting or doing emails. And I said, look, this company's paying you to be on this board. You have a fiduciary responsibility. Put your phone away. And, or if you have to take an emergency call, step out of the room. And the other pet peeve that I have is always prepare. If you're going to serve as a board member, you have to be prepared. If you come into a board meeting unprepared and don't read your material, I don't need you as a board member. You're not going to be effective. And so you have to learn to compartmentalize. And so being in board governance as well as a CEO, I have to practice what I preach as well.
One of the things I have a question asked of a number of executives who are at kind of that stage in the career, maybe mid-career, they're looking to get on a board, and that I probably get that question asked, do you know of any board seats that that are open or conversations I could have? What advice would you have for an executive that's looking for their first board seat? Anything particular that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I do have people ask me that, and, you know, the first thing I ask them is, do you have the time to be able to commit to this? Mm-hmm. It is a commitment, and if you're a full-time executive, I would say, and in a C-suite position, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of pressure, even at mid-career or even later in your career, I limit myself to one full board membership. Two, maybe at the maximum, but I do some advisory calls as well, just gratis work. But I would say don't overextend yourself. The other thing I would usually say is find out where you can really make a contribution. As a C-suite executive, what do you think, and pick a board very carefully. Pick one where you see some areas that could need improvement. You feel you have a skill set, and then market yourself that way. That's from finance people. I've had revenue cycle management people that I've talked to, have helped them get on some boards. And you know, if somebody is on a board that's been on for 10 years or more and just likes collecting the paychecks or the stock options,
right?
I usually try to cycle them off the board and get fresh blood in there. I think 5-7 years is a maximum for a board seat, and you need to keep the board fresh and fully engaged. But I think it's more of a bandwidth issue for me as I counsel them and mentor them. And it's also, you know, there are some extra duties and other governance issues as it relates to publicly traded companies versus private companies. And I would often suggest your first board seat maybe ought to be with a private company until you really learn the intricacies of running an SEC governed company, which is much different, and there's a lot more financial risk involved.
Yeah. So anything as far as kind of personally that you use, I'm kind of a techie, like new technologies, and sometimes it can be that thing that could be a distraction, but anything that you've purchased or you use on a daily basis that you think has helped you be more productive?
Yeah, I use iPhones and iPads. I have on my wrist a fitness watch, a Garmin watch that monitors blood pressure, steps. You know, my doctor says I listen to my body, so I have a lot of apps, including a blood pressure cuff app that's on my iPhone. I have news feeds and also different types of different things that help me in my current role that are streamed to my phone. So when I'm on a plane or I'm having some downtime and between meetings, I'll sometimes learn from those things. But at this stage of my career, I'm kind of into you know, monitoring my own body and making sure that I'm functioning on all cylinders. So, but I have probably too many apps, but the ones I don't use, here's my rule of thumb, Mark. If I don't use the app in 30 days, I discard it.
Got it. Get rid of the clutter.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Greg. This has been very informative. I definitely appreciate your time and your insights. And as always, it's been great to talk with you and wish you the best as you continue in your career.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.